In the year 1406, the mayor of London had to deal with a rather unusual complaint. There was this man, a resident of the city, called Richard Dodd. He was a tailor, and he resided in the ward of Bishopgate Without. Apparently, Richard Dodd was married to a woman called Margaret Dodd, and Margaret and Richard had an arrangement that Margaret would seek out the company of a chaplain called William Langford, and Margaret would sleep with him, and the chaplain would pay Richard Dodd 40 pence a week for the pleasure of her company. This rather salacious arrangement became known to their neighbours, and they decided to report this to the local officer of the ward's alderman, the beadle of the ward. And when he heard it, well, the affair got escalated up so that it ended up being presented to the mayor and the alderman. They reviewed the evidence and decided to punish Richard Dodd. He was sentenced to the pillory for arranging this immoral compact, and he was forced to face the public scorn and shame of the derision of his neighbours for 3 hours a day. I start with this story to remind us all that when talking about the past of epic kings and queens, of the great historical themes of English history, this podcast is dedicated to London, and the story of London is always the story of the people of London. People were living lives as complex and as ambiguous as ours seem to be. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast dedicated to the chronological tale of this great metropolis. And we are looking at events in the city between the years 1405 and 1410, plus having a look at events elsewhere. It's a complex era where a lot was going on, and I hope I can do it justice by, well, summarising it all within one podcast. And so without further ado, welcome to chapter 145 of the story, The Great Fishnet Rebellion of Barking. As we gaze at our city in 1405, we see the authorities trying to cope with the pressures of so many people living so close together. Understand, London back in the early part of the 15th century contained many elements we'd recognise in the 21st century, such as property deals. Like in 1405, we hear that over in Fleet Street, the Horn Tavern was given to the Goldsmiths Company by one of its members, quote, for the better support of the infirm members of the company, unquote. It was to remain in their possession for centuries. But as well as property deals, there were also property disputes, such as, well, we read of a complaint of a man called Robert Ashcombe, who complained about his neighbours, Gilbert Acon and his wife, Mazira. You see, Gilbert and Mazira Acon, like Robert Ashcombe, were quite rich, and they owned a series of tenements. And these were located in properties that adjoined Ashcombe's home. Robert Ashcombe came to the mayor to complain that the couple had, quote, diverse lights, windows, broken down walls, and openings to latrines, unquote, which were used by their tenants. And, well, Robert was upset because not only were they so close to his home he could see them using the bathroom, but also that they could, quote, see and hear the private business of the plaintiff and the members of his household, unquote. So not only was Robert Ashcombe complaining that his neighbours' tenants could see and hear into his house from their privies, it got worse because, quote, they throw filth and rubbish into his clothes, and evil odours come from their latrines, unquote. The sheriffs of London investigated this, and after consulting with masons and carpenters, the Acons were ordered to either repair the offending latrines or get rid of them. And we see a complaint from a merchant called Nicholas Wootton, who was upset about a mercer called Henry Bolesworth, who owned, quote, an old and ruinous wharf on the east side of his, which adjoins his tenement, unquote. Wootton was obsessed because Bosworth had allowed his wharf to fall into such a state of disrepair that it was, quote, on the point of collapsing into the Thames, unquote. This led to the mayor and six aldermen inspecting the site, and the small wharf that measured about 13 feet and 11 inches was ultimately declared to be, quote, very ruinous, unquote. This issue was resolved by ordering the mercer to, quote, repair and maintain it so that the wharves on either side do not suffer damage through his neglect, unquote. Ultimately, all of this is just showing that living in London and managing London was then, as now, an exercise in conflict resolution. People and property and their houses caused conflict. It was just part of the challenge of living day to day. And 1405 shows us that sometimes these challenges and conflicts could escalate very quickly. You see, one of our records of the city of that year clearly states, quote, and that year all the weirs between London and the Medway were drawn down by the council of the king and of the mayor of London, unquote. Now, as we've discussed in previous chapters, fishing in the Thames was big business. But fishing was never done by men with fishing lines, really, or by men just throwing nets. The erection of fish weirs, or permanent nets set in the river, was always the main way fish were caught in this era. And regular listeners may remember there have been numerous references in our story to the regulation of fishing on the river. Sometimes it's about who had jurisdiction over it. But there was always worries about the dangers of overfishing. There was, even back then, this idea that if you made your fish nets holes too small, young, smaller fish would be captured in the nets. And to not allow the fry to grow up would delete future fish stocks in the year ahead. We've mentioned in previous chapters how fish nets were gathered up by the London authorities and burned on Cheapside now and then. Now, what is also noticeable is that many of the offenders of this crime of having nets that were too small all seem to come from a couple of places down the river, Barking and Dagenham. And Barking especially was known for its fishermen. The town had an advantage. Barking owed much of its early importance to its position inside the pool where the River Roding joins the inlet of the Thames. From the 14th century until the mid-19th century, the most important industry of Barking was fishing. We know there was a fishery there in 1086, and this was probably only in the Roding, but our earliest mention of saltwater fishing on the Thames by Barking men was in 1320, where several of them had been prosecuted by the authorities of the City of London for using illegal nets. The same thing happened again in 1349, and now along comes 1405. And we have the description of the King and the City of London ordering the destruction of all the fish weirs down from the Thames to the Medway. That's a big reform, possibly caused by widespread overfishing, especially off young fish. And that would have hit the livelihoods of the fishermen of Barking, and probably caused a lot of resentment. And it's clear that this caused resentment because we know what happened the following year. In 1406, London sent down to the village an inspector of nets to make sure the notorious Barking fishermen were being compliant with the new regulations. They clearly were not being compliant. The inspector was seen making his way towards Barking, and tempers just boiled over. Before he could even arrive there, the bell in the local parish church of Barking began to toll, and by its sound, the men of the village gathered in force, armed, apparently with bows and arrows, and ready to kick off. Reports are unclear what happened. Some say there was definite violence or rioting, and others that it was simply a standoff. But in truth, the men of Barking had just taken up arms against the city official, an act of rebellion to protect their nets in defiance of the city that year. This, of course, could not stand. Villages and towns were not allowed to defy authority like this, and in quick order, the leading men of the village were arrested and brought to trial. Luckily, calmer heads prevailed. I mean, there was no real harm done, and any slights given were somewhat trivial. The men on trial and the village of Barking were allowed to return to their trade as fishermen. But of course, the banning of small-hold nets was enforced. Still, the Great Fishnet Rebellion is worthy of a mention. And thus London policed its own to a degree. While England faced growing political instability and conflict, London was trying its hardest to maintain stability. But there were reasons for this. Because London always had difficulty maintaining stability when the economic conditions were bad. And boy, were they bad. The renewal of the never-ending war with France in 1404 brought additional strains on the merchants of London, as once again shipping to and from the city and other English ports was exposed to the danger of privateers and attacks at sea. And economic rivalries actually led to new military ones which had economic consequences. For example, the English and London merchants had opened up some years previously the markets in the Baltic and towards the region we would call Prussia. Now, it's not the Prussia that would become famous. This is just a name we're giving to a really, really confusing mix of territories, nominally under the control of the Crusading Order of Teutonic Knights. Now, a London-based group of merchants, the Fraternity of St. Thomas of Canterbury, had supported the Crusades back in the 1370s or so, and as such had gained trade concessions in the region. These trade concessions were resented by the powerhouse of Germanic merchants in the region, the Hanse. The Hanse merchants, the great trading cities like Danzig, all seethed about this encroachment upon their traditional territories, and after some decades they had influenced the Prussian authorities to unilaterally terminate its commercial treaty with England in 1398. The Prussians had gone on to enforce rules restricting English settlement in and trade with their towns. The loss of trade from English and London-based merchants generated vast amounts of ill will towards the Germanic Hanse merchants, and this led to growing resentment towards the Hanse that spilled over into attacks by London merchants upon Hanse shipping. In 1404, two ships from Danzig sailing between England and Zealand were captured by a group of English ships, several of which were owned by grocers of London, John de Saint Germain, William Atwell, and John Mayhew. Now, shortly thereafter, John de Saint Germain was arrested and taken before the King's Council, but I cannot tell if it was because of the piracies committed by his ships or if he was suspected of being a lollard. Whatever action was taken against him, it did not stop the Hanse in 1405 from retaliating by prohibiting the trade in English cloth and the export of goods from the Baltic to England. This closing off an additional overseas market for English cloth struck at the interests of most London exporters, whatever their company, and it affected too the numerous artisans and retailers who were involved in the manufacture of English cloth and the transporting of English cloth across England for export. It just added to an ongoing mess. It is worth saying that here in the opening years of the 15th century, the wool trade and the question of where the wool staple would be located had stopped dominating and dividing the interests of the merchants of London, as it had done for most of the second part of the 14th century. The old rivalries between the staplers and the cloth merchants had faded away and ceased to poison the politics of the city. Londoners right now, like most of their fellow merchants throughout the whole of Europe, were pulling together as they had not done for a long time to defend their livelihoods against foreign rivals because of the brutal economic climate of the new century. I mean, you saw this manifested with the Common Council uniting in presenting the aldermen with articles they sought to confirm that most cherished of franchise. They wanted the aldermen of London to pass a new regulation, once again repeating the old policy of preventing foreigners from selling to each other within the city, and to ban citizens of London covering goods for them and passing them off as their own. They also made detailed provisions to ensure that all the cloth bought in the city by strangers had to be sold under the supervision of the Draper's Company at Bakewell Hall. It's notable to see that when the Common Council suggested this, the mayor was John Hend, a draper and an important creditor to the king. Hend was in his second term as mayor and had been one of London's mayors who had faced the wrath of Richard II in the last decade. It was the likes of him and Richard Whittington who had placated Richard II with generous contributions to the crown soon after, and this policy had continued under the new King Henry IV. Mayor Hend represented the face of the new political consensus in London. The city's organisation of the cloth trade was proving successful in forcing foreigners to buy their cloth from Londoners rather than from producers in London. Therefore, all Londoners had a stake in the success of Bakewell Hall. It's really interesting and with no little sense of irony. But these ongoing economic struggles had actually achieved what all the violence and plotting of Nicholas Brembe and John de Northampton had failed to do. And here we see the mercers, the drapers and the grocers all seem to be working together and being very happy of the supervision of the cloth trade by the drapers of London. I mean, better the drapers than the Italians, eh? But to repeat, this great sense of unity in London was being born out of serious economic contractions in England. And in fact, in 1409, you start seeing cost-cutting measures being suggested. And one of them is actually quite interesting. The Common Council of London that year suggested a new ordinance be passed that would have limited the amount of money livery companies would have to spend on their costly robes, basically preventing them from charging their members a fortune to look good. It was suggested that where the yearly processions of the livery companies took place going through London, more fortunes could be saved if they curtailed or maybe even stopped altogether, paying for separate bands of minstrels to lead their companies when they rode with the mayor. And it was suggested that rather than everyone wearing lots of different coloured expensive liveries, everyone should just agree to wear the city's red and white. You brought in these measures, you'd save a fortune. And while this petition was well-intentioned, and it reflected just how bloody expensive the outlay for those yearly professions were, it was never adopted or enforced. It failed. But the reason why it failed was actually fascinating. You see, even in the face of seriously reduced revenues, with there being a seemingly never-ending shortage of coin, and with all trade being fought over tooth and nail, for the big livery companies of London, there was much more important in those expensive gowns and large yearly processions than just looking good. The principal guilds of London attached staggering importance to the impression they created in public by their expenditure on expensive gowns and the hoods of their livery. Even when there were fewer of them in numbers, and indeed most of the larger and richer companies were seeing their numbers reduced in the face of decades-long economic contraction and a spike in bankruptcies, it seems the more they felt they had to put on a greater outward show. And why was this? Well, conspicuous expenditure created a sense of prestige, or to put it in the language of the time, worship. And worship was upheld or undermined particularly in the public processions which marked the passing of the civic year. This was the reason why the grocers, for example, would fine any of their members who did not take part in the processions. And they continued to pay between £2 or £4 a year just for minstrels when they rode with the sheriff and the mayor, or if they welcomed the king or the queen arriving in the city. Prestige, worship to the livery companies, was not just a matter of show. It was basically a shield, a buttress to the authority which the companies had to maintain their power over their trades, and by means of that, could influence the city's government. Visibly getting rid of such bling could not only undermine that authority, since it rested so much on the consent and common acceptance by everything that those suave dudes in the procession had the power to discipline members of their trade, conspicuous expenditure conveyed a sense of power. So when we refer to the Guilds of London as the worshipful company of drapers, goldsmiths and mercers, it's worth keeping in mind that worshipful in the 15th century is effectively slang for prestigious, or in more common parlance, bussin'. Personally, I like the idea of just renaming all the livery companies things like the Fire Drip Crew of Skinners, but that's because I can be very silly at times. And yet the economic issues impacting England presented the king, Henry IV, with the same dilemma as many of the previous kings had. Henry as king wanted to do right by his people, but he also needed cash. And the possible revenues from foreign merchants, who would pay big to be granted the right of the kingdom to trade wherever and however they wished, were always tempting. And that meant that cash-hungry kings got even more tempted to throw London under the bus. Henry had faced petitions from the commons in Parliament, pushed by the merchant class of the land, that all foreigners should be expelled from the kingdom. Of course, he refused to grant it, even if it did mean Parliament sulked for a few months about it. But he had no choice. The drastic fall in the output of royal mints made him very aware of the need to encourage foreign trade to come to England. And it was because of that that Henry IV actually briefly backstabbed the city. On the 1st of March 1406, the king passed a statute which permitted all alien merchants to trade freely wholesale in cloth and in other merchandise anywhere they wanted in the whole kingdom, including London. Looks like free trade was back on the menu, boys. The Londoners responded, however, not violently. This time it appears that they kind of sighed, went, oh God, not this shit again, and rolled up their sleeves. They had played this game before, and there is a sense of cynicism and professionalism in their response. The first move in 1407 was to re-elect William Stunton as mayor of the city. Stunton had been mayor once before, and crucially, he had been the mayor who had talked down Richard II in 1394 to restore the rights of London. Mayor William does seem to have been chosen as the guy who smooths things over when the kings get nasty. Staunton was a grocer, and it's noticeable that just before or after his election, three grocers appeared before the King's Council as part of London's response to Henry IV's ruling the year before. And by the Parliament of 1407, a petition was put forward to exempt London from the King's new free trade for foreigners rule. And it worked. London gained an exemption. Way to go, London. Regardless of this, in the following year, the merchants of Florence did appear more prominently than ever in the city's records, arranging foreign exchange, while the sales of cloth to Italians in London overtook the exports of both the English and the Hanse. And while London had gained an exemption to this regulation, the rest of the country had not. And to cut a long story of economic cause and effect short, many merchants and shopkeepers in provincial towns around the country now began to see their trade diminish, and their sons who had gone to London to learn their craft as apprentices found fewer openings in the provinces for them to return to. And there does genuinely seem to have been a diminishing of many of the old regional trading centres. And as such, we see the rise of importance once again of the regional fairs. Because of all this, the pattern of trade from London had to adapt. From just before 1410 and going forward, we see that since the overseas staple that was now permanently based in Calais, Londoners would buy raw wool at the fairs with the proceeds of the imported goods they sold at the same fairs. With less ready money and credit available, the fairs once again provided the easiest method of exchange, as well as a convenient meeting place for London's wholesalers and the country chapmen. Now, I mentioned chapmen at the start of the last chapter, describing them as itinerant booksellers. Chapmen are here in the start of the 15th century, and they're far more than that. They were travelling merchants around the lanes and byways of England. Some were like the traditional image we have of tinkers carrying pots and pans and various wares from village to village, but some were far more professionally organised enterprises. And about now, the chapmen were beginning to take over much of the distribution of goods around the country as the hard-pressed market towns buckled under the oppression of the prevailing economic conditions. And the chapmen realised that rather than looking to the provincial towns as the place they get their supplies, they found they could obtain better terms and make way more profit by buying directly from London's wholesalers, either in the city or in the fairs. So people were coping, but the economic situation was bad and London was having to adapt. Oh, and one final part of the economic mess going on right now must be mentioned. The price of pepper went through the roof, but that was due to events taking place in the Middle East. You see, in 1400, one of the greatest warlords ever seen in human history, arrived in the region, Timur, or Tamerlane. This great conqueror was a child of the steppes and a warlord like no other. Descended of a mix of two great steppe cultures, the Turks and the Mongols, Tamerlane had created a vast empire based around his distant city and capital of Samarkand. But his empire was really little more than a polity designed for him just to continue to wage war. He had subjugated the many lands of the great Ilkhanate, crushed the Golden Horde off the Russian steppes, and smashed into India to force the surrender of the Sultanate of Delhi. And by 1400, his ferocious forces fell upon Syria. All fell before him. His forces destroyed and subjugated the cities of Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Baalbek, and Damascus. None could stand before him. And in response to this, Venetian merchants who'd been active in the region were forced to relocate to Egypt, along with everybody else who'd been active in that region. And the competition in this market for pepper and spices saw the price shoot through the roof. In the second half of the 14th century, pepper was generally costing about 60 dinars for a measure in Egypt, whereas at the end of the first decade of the next century, the same amount of pepper cost 200 dinars. The Italians, because of this, began reducing the scale of their purchases in the great port of Alexandria from at least 1408, because they obviously figured that the European market could not bear the increased prices and still allow them to make their customary profit of 50% by shipping it across the Med. What pepper they did end up bringing to London had to be increased in price to match the rise in Alexandria, and the London grocers had therefore to charge the new price or reduce all their profits drastically. The rise in the price of pepper caused the rich customers of England to balk at that, and the king issued an edict that said it could only be sold at 20p a pound, which destroyed any profits and threatened the whole retail trade, since pepper accounted for about 75% of all the spices imported. Another strand, onwards and onwards goes this never-ending economic crisis. By 1407, however, London had to this another new nightmare to deal with. The plague returned. Sometime between 1405 and 1407, this first outbreak of the plague this century turned out to be an especially vicious one. One writer at the time said, quote, "So great a pestilence had not been seen for many years," unquote. And this writer went on to say that London saw 30,000 men and women die in a very short space of time. This plague was like the others. Quote, "In country villages, the sickness fell so heavily upon the wretched peasants that many homes that had before been gladdened by numerous family were left almost empty," unquote. We know that one account of the time said that the king, to avoid the city on account of the plague, sailed from Queenborough to a port in Essex and so to Plessey, quote, "there to pass his time till the plague had ceased," unquote. And another chronicler says that the plague of 1407, despite how vicious it was on London, was actually mostly based over in the West Country. We see petitions from towns in Devon and Somerset who applied for remission of taxes for, well, in one case, quote, "because the town is so impoverished and desolate of people that the burgesses are unable to pay," unquote, and in another, quote, "that the said town is impoverished by pestilence and the death of men, and by invasions and loss by enemy at sea," unquote, referring to the raids by pirates and the French. The plague that year had left a devastated land. So London is recovering, coping with hard times. But you know what? So was the rest of England. And politically in England, things were getting very interesting and confusing. I do not intend to spend too much time talking about the reign of Henry IV. It's a tale unto itself. But I need to address something here and now. We are a few years away from that most glorious of English kings, Henry V, taking the throne of England. And it must be said that since the era of Shakespeare, we have this lovely story of the young Prince Henry, the Prince of Wales, basically spending his time in London's many bars and stews, sowing his wild oats, ignoring his father, and hanging out with London ne'er-do-wells and lowlifes like Falstaff, aka Sir John Oldcastle. It's a marvellous tale, and I wish I could tell you it was true. But alas, it's not. not even slightly. Young Prince Henry was by all accounts a young man who was growing up knowing he was due to become king, and working closely with his father to make damn sure he would inherit a stable regime. From 1400 to 1404, young Prince Henry carried out the duties of the Constable of Cornwall, and it was because of this that when rebellion erupted in Wales, the young prince was sent north to manage it. Of course, he was just a teenage boy, aged about 15, and this led to him being given support by others, including Henry Hotspur Percy. On the 1st of April 1403, Prince Henry, now turning 16, took up office as Royal Lieutenant throughout Wales, with an annual salary of £8,108, which would allow him to maintain a force of about 500 men-at-arms and 2,500 archers. So armed that April and May of the year, the 16-year-old sent forces to relieve beleaguered English garrisons in Harlech and Aberystwyth and to destroy Owen Gwynedd's estates. But by the time the prince returned to his headquarters at Shrewsbury that May, Owen Gwynedd was already gathering a new force said to be about 8,000 strong. And at the same time, something else happened. Percy family was feeling rather aggrieved. They had undertaken great feats to defend England during Henry IV's reign. Hotspur had won the king a huge victory over the Scots and supplemented Prince Henry's forces as a young man was coming up in Wales. Of course, Henry IV was never the most financially prudent of the kings, and as such, the Percy family felt hard done by the amount of monies they were getting, given the amount of victories they were bringing to the king. Of course, this is a very simplistic explanation of a very complex sequence of events. But in short, the rewards the young prince gained were seen as somewhat of a slap in the face of the Percy family. And it didn't help that the Welsh then mounted a huge counterattack that made the young prince's military gains suddenly pale into insignificant. Henry Hotspur Percy was then travelling from the Scottish border to Wales again to supplement the forces of the young teenager. And he arrived in Chester on the 9th of July 1403. And it was there that Hotspur decided he was going to rebel. He proclaimed that Richard II was actually still alive and all those who wished to overthrow King Henry should make their way to Sandyway, a dozen miles east of Chester, where the former king would be arriving. Despite this dubious claim, he did manage to recruit an army of former royalists to Richard II, and then he moved this several thousand strong force southwards along the Welsh border towards Shrewsbury. His aim was to take on what he believed to be the only royalist forces in the Midlands, the 3,000 or so men under young Prince Henry, and overwhelm them before the king had a chance to react. What changed the situation was that the king was unexpectedly on his way to the Midlands. The king had remarried that February and remained close to London since then, so they could keep an eye on ongoing French and English peace negotiations across the Channel. These were concluded with a truce on the 27th of June, and the king had moved north unexpectedly and walked into Hotspur's rebellion. Henry's rapid advance surprised Hotspur, who'd been preparing to besiege Prince Henry in Shrewsbury, but now retreated a few miles northwest. And on Saturday, the 21st of July, 1403, the two sides faced each other a few miles just beyond Shrewsbury. The battle which followed is noticeable because it was the first time that huge formations of Welsh and English bowmen, the longbowmen who had terrorised the French and the Scots for decades, ever actually faced each other. And the result of this was genuinely one of the bloodiest battles ever fought during the medieval era. Henry IV had basically placed his army into three divisions, with a vanguard under the command of the 25-year-old Earl of Stafford, a rearguard under his 16-year-old son, and with him in the middle. The battle saw it rain arrows as longbowmen of both sides fired arrow after arrow at their peers, and eventually the 4,000 men of the king's vanguard broke and fled, the young Earl of Stafford, one of those slain by the arrow storm. With all their arrows fired, and in the face of this, the rebels, led by Hotspur, launched a frontal assault on the division commanded by the king. It was a gamble born of desperation. For the rebels, King Henry IV could not be allowed to either live or escape from this battle. It was all or nothing. And the fighting was vicious. An indication of just how intense it was that the royal standard bearer, Sir Walter Bluett, who was one of two men wearing the royal arms so as to act as a battlefield decoy, was actually killed, and the fighting came close to killing the king himself. He was persuaded to retreat, but just as he did, Prince Henry led the rear guard in an equally desperate counterattack. During this, the 16-year-old prince was hit in the face by an arrow, the wooden shaft getting lodged in his skull about an inch below his right eye. Prince Henry did not hesitate at this and pressed the attack and broke through Hotspur's lines. And at some point right now, Hotspur was slain and his forces broke. This Battle of Shrewsbury was utterly vicious, more savage than any battle seen in contemporary English history. Around 2,000 bodies, perhaps more, were buried in a mass grave on the site of the battle, and others as far away as 3 miles distant. And a further 3,000 more were wounded, some of whom subsequently died. One writer at the time describes the horror of this entire battle. Quote, "Father killed son and son killed father, kin slew kin and neighbour slew neighbour," unquote. Those injured faced brutal wounds. The Earl of Douglas, commanding some of the rebel forces, had been struck in the groin and lost a testicle. But all eyes were looking at the vicious injury the young 16-year-old Prince of Wales had taken. He was left with an arrow stuck deep into his face, just below his right eye. What follows, we know from accounts of the surgeon John Bradmore, is one of medieval England's most graphic accounts of ongoing battlefield injury and surgery. The surgeon had to get the arrow out of the young man's face, and if he failed, this kid would die. There was no question about it. Having removed the arrow shaft, he wrote, quote, "The head of the aforesaid arrow remained in the furthermost part of the bone of the skull for the depth of 6 inches, unquote. He had to remove it. Not an easy task given the nature of medical science in the day. Bradmore fashioned some probes from, quote, "The pith of old elder, well dried and well stitched in purified linen cloth, the length of the wound. These probes were infused with rose honey. And after that, I made larger and longer probes, until I had the width and the depth of the wound as I wished. Then I prepared anew some little tongs, small and hollow, with the width of an arrow. A screw ran through the middle of the tongs. I put these tongs in at an angle in the same way the arrow had first entered, then placed the screw in the centre, and finally the tongs entered the socket of the arrowhead. Then, by moving it to and fro, little by little, with the help of God, I extracted the arrowhead," unquote. The process was extraordinarily painful. There was a real fear that the young prince would go into spasm from the agony, so Bradmore massaged the prince's neck every morning with a muscle relaxant and placed a hot plaster on it to soothe him. When the arrowhead was finally extracted from his face, he then went on to cleanse the wound with white wine before inserting wads of flax soaked in white bread, barley flour, honey and turpentine oil. Every 2 days he shortened the wads. And within 20 days, the wound had actually healed over and a, quote, "dark ointment," unquote, was applied to regenerate his flesh. He was left with a horrendous scar and also a reputation of incredible courage in remaining on the field and leading a counterattack. The battle had saved the Lancasterian dynasty, no bones about it. Had Henry IV been captured or killed, he would have been portrayed as a usurper and joined the list of wannabe kings of this land. But as it was, it saved him and his line, even if his victory meant he was back dealing with an unstable kingdom and an ongoing economic crisis he had no chance of solving. And while the king and his heir had avoided disaster at Shrewsbury, it had been a close-run thing. Prince Henry had came within an inch of losing his life, literally. And the king had just seen how many people in England, Wales and Scotland had come to believe he deserved the same fate as Richard II. Over the remainder of this decade then, Henry had faced ongoing war with Wales, renewed hostilities with France, rebellion in Ireland, and a plethora of plots and intrigues against him within England. To say he was beleaguered is an understatement. Henry IV had taken the crown of England and it must have felt like a poisoned chalice. At every turn he was faced with difficult choices, and each decision seemed to backfire upon him. But by 1405, there's a brief glimmer. Well, he seems to be starting to turn things around. And during this era, we see from financial records a plethora of repayments to, quote, the good people of London, unquote, as Henry tried his very best to cover his debts to them and numerous others. He was working flat out. But by 1408, the pressure of it seemed to get to him. By the end of May that year, after travelling to Yorkshire to deal with another attempted rebellion against him, he was back in the Tower of London, and then travelled upriver to stay with Archbishop Arundel at Mortlake. But there, in Mortlake, he suddenly collapsed. What was hitting him? We actually don't know. We know at the time many people said it was leprosy, but we don't think it was. What we do know is that the symptoms evidently did include a disfiguring skin disease, which may have included symptoms such as a burning sensation, pustules on his face and hands, and a, quote, festering of the flesh and dehydration in the eyes, unquote. It was painful and disfiguring, whatever it was. The king remained at Mortlake for nearly a month, only resuming work in mid-July, and for the rest of his life his health remained precarious. He now travelled more by water and often preferred the seclusion of friends' houses to the grandeur of royal residences, and he was prone to relapses in this illness. By December 1408, it was thought too prudent to recall Prince Henry to Westminster just in case his father died. By the middle of January 1409, the king suffered another relapse and believed himself to be dying. On the 21st of January, he made a will regretting his misspent life, and 4 days later actually issued a general pardon for those who'd rebel against him. But he survived. And his health was an issue we will come back to at a future chapter. Richard Whittington had become Mayor of London for a third time in 1406, just as the plague was erupting in the city, and perhaps this is why in 1409 he paid for the rebuilding of his local church, St. Michael Pest and Oster Royal. He lived next door to the church in the house adjoining, and it was here that he would eventually be buried. But as we leave London in early 1409, let us leave the city with a report of that year of the severe winter. Quote, "This year was the great frost and ice and the most sharpest winter ever man saw," unquote. For 14 weeks, the temperature was below zero as howling winds and snows turned everything white and into ice. The River Thames was said to have frozen, quote, "so that man might in diverse places go and ride over the Thames," unquote. This was London, freezing, struggling to cope economically, living cheek by jowl and complaining about their neighbours, surviving diseases and national political instability, coping with life. Events like the Great Fish Rebellion of Barking Town would quickly fade from memory. New issues arose. The story of London is a story of the people of London, and in the winter of 1409 we have them staring out into the white wonderland of a frozen river, the bitter cold, wondering what was to come, and having no idea just how extreme their future was to be. I'm going to leave that chapter there. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week for another chapter of the story of London. This is Saul saying bye.